States versus Wilson. Ms. Judge.
May it please the court. My name is Mary Judge, and I represent Robert Wilson, the appellant. Robert Wilson is asking this court to reverse his conviction because the lower court violated his right to due process of law as provided in the Fifth Amendment and also violated his Sixth Amendment right to put on a defense. He's going to argue the first issue and will rest on the briefs as to the second. This case involved the fraudulent wire transfer of $180,000. In order to convict Robert Wilson, the government introduced the inculpatory portions of his post-arrest, post-Miranda statement as recorded by their case agent. Prior to trial, the district court, in limine ruling, held that the government could not introduce any evidence of Robert Wilson's refusal to answer certain questions pursuant to Doyle.
But, you know, you're reading Doyle in a rather broad way that doesn't take into account later, let's say, qualifications. I'm thinking of cases like United States against Davenport. If a defendant within a subject matter starts down an exculpatory path and says some things, then the government's entitled to introduce even silence to just give the rest of the story. Now, it doesn't mean they can go on to a new topic if there's a valid reassertion of Miranda, you know, of the right to remain silent. That's a different thing. But I don't see anything in Doyle that says you get to pick, you know, sort of cherry pick the story and compel silence on the government that you didn't say certain other things that might have been incriminating.
Well, I think this court in United States versus Scott addressed that issue when it stated that Miranda can be invoked in a case on a question-by-question basis.
The question, what does that mean? I mean, does that mean, because the thing is, there are other cases we have, Davenport happens to be one of our cases, too, that indicate that, in a sense, as to each particular topic, the government's entitled to put the full context in front of a jury. And so, I'm not sure how atomistic we want to get with the question by question, how atomistic, in fact, we have gotten with the question by question basis.
I think my reading of the cases in this circuit are the situation in Doyle was that you can't use someone's silence against you. Then United States versus Anderson says, well, if you do choose to make statements, we can impeach you as to your testifying at trial inconsistent with those statements. And then the government cites to Grieco and United States versus Scott. Those cases, I believe, are distinguishable from the facts in this case. In those cases, the defendants claim that the defendants had first made a statement and then at trial added details to that statement and tried to claim when the government cross-examined them as to their silence regarding the additional details at the time of their arrest, tried to raise a Doyle violation there, and that's when the court stated that they can look at the context, the entire context, that it's not a Doyle violation because first he didn't
isn't that the situation here?
Because the situation there, the defendant was claiming that his silence, so to speak, was his lack of informing the arresting officers of those additional details. He never reasserted his rights to Miranda or refused to answer questions.
No, but I mean, look, he says he wants apparently to say that he had an associate, all right?
Right.
Then he told the police he had an associate.
Right.
But he also refused to name the associate. Isn't that necessary to put his discussion in context?
Well, I think Doyle protects you. When you're interviewed, you are given the right to make statements, and Miranda is protected question by question.
But if you want to use those statements, why can't the government show that the truthfulness of them is is cast into doubt by your refusal to amplify.
Well, these statements weren't being introduced with the defendant testifying about those statements. This statement was being introduced in response to putting in context what the government had already introduced.
I know, but you wanted to use this as evidence that he had mentioned an associate. But when it turns out that he didn't name the associate, that isn't that necessary for a jury to figure out the significance of his having said he had an associate?
Well, I think Doyle still protects his refusal to give that answer.
Even if it's misleading?
It's not misleading in the context that we wanted to introduce it.
The government
introduced evidence, and we wanted to complete the evidence, put it in complete context.
And they wanted to complete it the rest of the way, I think. I mean, the problem is your reading of Doyle, well, perhaps at one point one that might have been a reading of Doyle isn't the one, as I see it, that this circuit has taken, that it's that specific, not to mention the fact that I don't see that he was actually re-invoking his right to remain silent when he says, I'm not going to answer that question. He goes on and chats with him for quite a while after that.
Right. It's clear that a person can re-invoke their right to remain silent and remain silent for the remainder of the interview.
Right. That's not at all what this person does.
That's right. But a person can also can re-invoke Miranda question by question, which means you can be interviewed, answer questions, and refuse to answer other questions, and that's exactly what he did here. He was given his Miranda rights. He was told he didn't have to answer questions. He chose to answer questions, and he chose not to answer others. What the government was trying to do, or what the court was allowing them to do, was bring in his silence, use his silence against him, his refusal to answer questions in the face of Miranda, for the purpose of evidencing guilt, to show that he was more than likely guilty because he refused to answer that question. And I believe that is contrary to Anderson and Doyle and the cases in this circuit.
Okay, now you've been arguing the merits, but I bet anything Mr. Berkowitz is going to stand up and tell us that you've waived the right to discuss any of this, since it's been a long time in this brief discussing that point. The trial court gave you a choice. You could question the agent about the statement Wilson made and have the government come in with silence, or you could refrain from questioning the agent, keep out the testimony, and then the government wasn't going to be allowed to mention the silence. A difficult choice, but why isn't that enough? Why isn't that the kind of thing that you can't complain about?
Well, the government based its argument of waiver on a couple of cases that I believe are factually distinguishable from our particular case. First, they cited to Luce versus United States.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about
and
that.
And that is a case that has to do with the defendant not testifying, and the reasoning behind that. That case involved impeaching a defendant with his prior convictions, and there the Supreme Court held the defendant cannot not testify and then claim that his rights were violated unless he testified. And that case is very distinguishable because, as the court pointed out, every case would be a windfall for a defendant if they chose not to testify, or if they did testify and he was impeached, then he would be given a windfall. We don't have those facts in this case. The second case the government cites too is Wilson v. Williams, and that case is also distinguishable.
Well, that's contingent rulings and motions in limine, but it seems to me here, again, he knows, you know, here's what's going to happen. I can either get in this evidence about the statement at the price of the jury finding out that I wouldn't say anything about the associate. Obviously, he's not even testifying, as you pointed out. It's the agent who would be doing this, so it's one step removed. Or he can just keep the whole thing out. So the question really is that an illegitimate choice for the district court to put him to? I think particularly under Luce. I don't think Williams has much to do with this, actually. I don't see anything conditional about the ruling.
Right. I find that the ruling itself was definitive and clear, and on the record the judge explained to us that he understood that what we were preserving. I don't think there was any question as to his ruling being definitive. And I think for that reason it was not a conditional ruling, and that we have not waived our rights.
Well, you want to reserve the balance of your time for rebuttal?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Berkowitz?
Good May it please the court. The district court in this case appropriately exercised its discretion with respect to both of the evidentiary issues before this court. With respect to the first issue, which is the issue of the introduction of exculpatory statements that the defendant made post-arrest through the case agent in the defense's case in chief, Judge Wood is correct that the government's position is this court need not even address the merits. Mr. Wilson was given the choice at trial by Judge Moran to either go into this area and allow the government to put forth the fact that he did not identify an associate, or he was given the choice to let the record stand as it was. He chose.
Of course, it's a little bit unlike Luce, because we didn't know in Luce, the court didn't know, what would happen if the defendant testified. It was very abstract. Whereas here, we have the proffer from the FBI agent. We know exactly what the agent would testify regarding what Wilson said, and we know exactly what the agent would testify regarding what Wilson didn't say. And if, hypothetically, I know this isn't the government's position, but if there really were a Doyle right not to have that evidence of silence brought in, you put Wilson in a far worse position, because even on appeal, he would have to face arguments of harmless error and of constitutionally harmless error and all the rest of it. And if he really has a right to keep the evidence out, is the district court entitled, in a case that doesn't present the uncertainties that Luce did, is the district court entitled to put him to a potentially illegitimate choice?
Putting aside the merits, which I'll discuss in a minute, Your Honor, in this case, although the 302 is bantied about in the defendant's rebuttal brief as this is what we were going to do, on the record, when asked specifically, what is it you're looking to do, defense counsel wouldn't articulate exactly what it was they were attempting to elicit. And frankly, if they attempted to throw the entire 302 into the mix, there were evidentiary issues and rules of completeness issue with respect to various bits and pieces of the 302 that, in all likelihood, at least in the government's view, would not have been introduced. And therefore, this court has put at a disadvantage by the defendant not invoking the choice to put in to see what effects, if any, this would have had.
So that's a different procedural point you're making, because you're suggesting that if he had made an adequate proffer based on the 302, then maybe the judge couldn't have put him to that choice, but without knowing exactly what it is.
That's correct. That's more an offer of proof issue,
yeah,
Judge.
It's a different kind of argument.
And in addition to that, with respect to Luce, here we have some sense as to what the choice was and what the ramifications would have been to Defendant Wilson, and a little bit more so than Luce. But the reasoning in Luce is still applicable here, because the defendant was given a choice, and the court still does not know the full effect as to what the testimony would have been and what effect, if any, it would have had on Mr. Wilson, or whether, in fact, they would have chosen to introduce this. They said that they were going to introduce reliance on an associate, but there's no certainty that they would have.
Is there any doubt in this record that the associate we're all talking about is Mr. Gibbons?
There is. It would have been the government's theory at trial that the associate was Mr. Gibbons, but there certainly was doubt, and there's nothing that is clear in the record. Mr. Gibbons, although available as a witness, did not testify, and if defendant had gone down this road, the government may have called Mr. Gibbons as a rebuttal witness. But the issue of putting an unnamed associate out there without tying up anything more in any concrete way doesn't give this court a basis to determine whether, in fact, there was any choice put to the defendant which implicated his rights in any way. With respect to the merits of the issue, which I will touch on briefly, this is not a situation where the government, although the government attempted to, it's not, the present posture of the court is not one where the government affirmatively put in this testimony in its case in chief. It comes to this court on the issue of the defendant attempts in their case to affirmatively put in, through the case agent, without having the defendant testify, exculpatory portions of the post-arrest statement, in a sense attempting to put in the entire defense based on craft the entire defense based on the defendant's post-arrest statements. They wanted to then, in the government, if that were to come in, said if that's the case, there has to be provided a proper context so the jury can judge the credibility of that. Essentially, the district court appropriately held that it would unduly skew things to allow just the exculpatory portions of the statement to come in without a broader explanation. What defendant wants to do here is to use Doyle as a tool to fashion an uncontradicted version and a distorted version of his post-arrest statement. There's also a question, as Judge Wood brought out, as to whether Doyle is even impacted on the facts of this case, and the government would suggest that it is not. This is not a situation where the defendant reinvocated his right to remain silent. In fact, the district court, in a factual finding, made that determination that it was not a reinvocation of right. Rather, it was a strategic choice on his part to not identify the associate, recognizing that if he did, the government would talk to that associate and determine that the associate wouldn't back this story up. In that context, the defendant cannot be allowed to cherry-pick, as Judge Wood mentioned, what portions of a statement come in and what portions don't. Because ultimately, once the defendant puts this into issue, the determination is one of truth-seeking, so that the jury can properly evaluate and determine what the truth is, not to properly distort for the jury what the defendant's view of the world is without a further description as to the realities of the situation. With respect to the second issue, the government would also rest on its brief, and we would ask the court, if there are no further questions, to affirm the conviction and sentence of Mr. Wilson.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Berkowitz.
Thank you.
Mr. Judge, how much time do you have?
As this court has stated, errors of constitutional dimension, such as due process violations here, are more freely noticed and are less serious non-constitutional errors. This court agreed with the Fifth Circuit in Maverick when it stated that the circumstances under which comment upon silence of the accused will not occasion reversal are few and discreet. This is not one of those few and discreet circumstances. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Judge, and we thank the Defender Service for usual vigorous representation of clients.